Major General Laird at Reel 2. General, you were talking about the mechanical problems involved with the Vickers medium. How did you find the crews working on them? Did they have problems?
No, I think that by the time a tank crew had been together for a bit, they learnt these tanks. They were really quite simple, in actual fact, compared with, for instance, shall we say, Chieftain today. And they soon learnt them. The drivers were usually men of more experience than the others, and they soon learned to do their maintenance. And they had to do their maintenance because there was nobody else except the company fitters. And they were capable of doing a great deal to the tank, for instance, changing all the plugs and those sort of things, which would never be allowed now to a tank crew. It would be a matter for Remy to do. And they were well trained, and they were all of them very interested, the tank crews. And they had a great competition to keep their tanks on the road, because it was quite a hard job to do, and they were always doing their best to beat the other fella.
What would you say would be the principal mechanical problem?
One of the worst things was the petrol pump, which was a spindle-driven pump with a very thin, rather inadequate spindle, and the spindle was continually breaking. You got no indication of it until all of a sudden your carburetors went dry and the engine stopped. So this might happen at any awkward moment, like on a bridge or anything else. We also used to have a considerable amount of trouble with the bogey wheels. They used to seize and sometimes come off. And it had a rather very complicated method of steering. And the steering used to give a lot of trouble, the steering gear, generally. Engines were quite reliable. They were 90 horsepower, a V8 engine. I think it was V8, yes, V8 engine, made by Armstrong Siddeley. Quite reliable, the engines themselves. But some of the ancillary things were not so good.
You mentioned that you went on exercises down to Salisbury Plain.
So Sussex, actually, in this particular case.
Yes. What were the main objectives of the exercise?
Well, that particular exercise, 1928, was the 1st Division against the 2nd Division. They were the two leading divisions in the BEF, if ever there was to be one. And they had various operations they carried out against each other and individually within the divisions. And we at one time supported the 2nd Division, which was our division. Later on, we divided. One of our companies went off to the other division because they hadn't got any tanks. And we had various... one large exercise at the end of the month, I think it was a month or 6 weeks we were there, one large exercise at the end where a big movement was carried out, and our particular division, the 2nd Division, outmaneuvered the 1st Division very considerably. But I remember very well, long before I ever came to live in this area, I remember coming through Arundel at night in a flank march, which we carried out by night, through crossing the Arundel Bridge and getting round the enemy flank. But there were big manoeuvres, and I think there was a great deal of damage done and compensation paid afterwards to farmers and all this sort of thing. That sort of thing doesn't seem to be done today, but in those days one got the Manoeuvre Act was put into force, and you were allowed to go almost anywhere. There were certain limitations, but you were allowed to go across fields and all this sort of thing as much as you wanted to.
Did you find that you were operating against infantry? Did you find that you were, in fact, demoralising them? This has been said about those exercises.
Well, at times you got rather close to them. We were always limited rather than what we could do. I once drove over the bicycles of an infantry battalion and caused the most appalling fuss and bother and courts of inquiry and things of this sort. They were on one side of a fence and I didn't see them. But on the whole, the infantry they always claimed they'd knocked us out. With what was never very clear, because they didn't have any anti-tank guns. They carried wooden flags and things of that sort representing anti-tank guns. There were no anti-tank guns at all in the service in those days. But I think we made a great bang and fired our guns off. It was always very hard to say who'd won any of these battles.
Did you see yourselves as specialists in armoured warfare?
Oh, yes. We thought we were rather good, you know. We were rather proud of ourselves. And being the only corps of its sort in the army was considered by us to be something rather special. We thought a lot of... we, of course, always thought the cavalry were out of date. And when they made such a fuss about being mechanised, we could never see why. We only had to look to what they'd done at Cambrai, for instance, to realise that cavalry were completely out of date in modern war.
You mentioned that you'd done this night exercises. What do you think was the thinking behind this night work?
Well, we never actually... I don't think we ever actually fought at night, as far as I remember. It was all movement. We were moving somewhere to carry out an operation early morning, that sort of thing. I think I'm right in saying we, in those, I can't remember very well, but in those particular operations we crossed the Downs up by Rackham Clump and came down on the other side into Parham Park at night. It was quite a thing to do along little narrow tracks across the Downs. And in the morning we carried out a flank attack on the infantry, enemy infantry, who were in position in the Storrington area somewhere. I don't think we ever did any night fighting as such. I don't think we could possibly have done so. We had no lighting arrangements or that sort of all.
So you felt the morale was quite good, was it, after those exercises?
Yes, I always think the morale in the Royal Tank Corps was high at that time. It wasn't quite so high later after the Abyssinian crisis, but at that time it was. We thought we were very good, and I think we were, as far as our limitations of equipment allowed.
You were in medium tanks. Were there mechanical problems on those exercises?
Oh, well, always, tanks were always falling out, with this or that or the other wrong with them. And the squadron fitters used to follow along in a lorry behind the squadron and do something for the tank and bring it along later. But it was the crews did their utmost not to fall out. Everyone used to try and keep the tanks going, whatever happened.
What about armament? Were you satisfied with the gun that you had?
We really hardly knew how to be satisfied. We didn't quite know what we were doing with them. We were going to fire enemy tanks. We had solid shot. As far as machine guns were concerned, they were very reliable. Vickers gun was a reliable gun of the First World War. Not very suitable for tanks because it was water-cooled, of course. But I think we were quite... I'm not sure that there's one thought about that sort of thing very much. I don't think one thought, is this a good gun or a bad gun? It was the gun you had and you had to be satisfied with it. I mean, one must remember, I'm talking of times, and I was only a second lieutenant. I wasn't really involved in anything very great.
Was there much reference made to the 1927 Experimental Armoured Force exercises on this one?
Well, no, we were not involved in this at all. As far as I can remember, the 2nd Battalion hadn't taken part in those operations. I believe they were done on the plain, and I don't think we ever took part in them. But they did. We did have... I think we had a certain number of the Carden Lloyd... the first Carden Lloyd carrier at about that time, which had wheels and tracks. And I believe they were one of the vehicles that they did use in those operations. But I don't remember myself that the thing was ever really brought to our notice so much, at my level.
Later on that year, in 1928, the decision was taken to, in fact, disband the idea of the experimental...
I believe it was, yes.
Did that affect you in any way, I mean, in terms of morale?
No, I don't think we were... I doubt me whether the young officer, as I was really affected by that sort of thing very much. I don't think so, no. I don't remember, anyway, that it had any effect on us.
When you went to India, what was your principal duties at Kota?
Well, I went off to India in 1930. I sailed to India in February 1930. And I was appointed to the 10th Armoured Car Company, which was in Quetta, in Baluchistan. And we had, at that time, Guy Armoured Cars. They were the only we were the only company equipped with them, and they were very, very fine vehicles for the time. They were six-wheelers, with very powerful engines. They carried two Vickers machine guns. They were reasonably armoured for the sort of bulletproof armouring that was necessary. And they were very reliable. One of them, in my section, was a special one, actually had power steering, which is the first time I'd ever come across such a thing, and the first time one had ever heard of it. They were built by Guy Motors, who were then a separate company, in the north, Birmingham somewhere. And they had been bought by the Indian government. The British government didn't own any of these vehicles. We were very proud of them. What one did was one trained with the Quetta division. One did a good deal of training with Indian Army, both with cavalry and infantry. One did patrols on the roads, although that part of the country was quiet, of course. Baluchistan wasn't like Waziristan. There was no fighting going on of that sort. But we did patrols, and there were occasions when people were kidnapped, that sort of thing, when we had to go out. We used to run up to the Afghan border, and we used to go out on section duty by oneself. I think one of the things that I would draw attention to was that in the battalion in England, one had, as a second lieutenant, practically no responsibility. You commanded a section, but there were probably, or you may have been only second in command of a section. You couldn't do anything on your own without being told what to do. In India, quite different. We had a section of five cars, two 30 hundredweight lorries, two motorcycles, about 35 men, with a sergeant, and second lieutenant, I was still a second lieutenant then, in command. And you were sent off. You were suddenly told to go to, shall we say, Fort Sandeman and do training with, in my case, I remember the 13th Lancers, Indian Cavalry. So I went off. It was 100 miles or something away from company. One motored all that way. One got there. One had to find one's own arrangements, looking after troops and so on. The Indian Cavalry were always very nice to us, and we did exercises with them, and they laid down little schemes which we used to take part in and so on. Maybe the colonel came to see you. The commanding officer came to see you once while you were there, and eventually you were ordered home again. Back you had to go with all your troops and so on. You were responsible for it all. You were on your own, and you really had to command your men, and you really had to see that your vehicles ran and that you did what the cavalry wanted to do. And it was a complete tonic to everybody, soldiers as well. And this was really something. One enjoyed those far more than when we were actually in barracks in Quetta, when, of course, there was a great deal of ceremonial and dressing up in our best clothes and marching and parading and guards and all this sort of thing. But the whole atmosphere of India was so much better. We were A, fully equipped. B, we had all the troops we wanted. We were at full strength. C, we had as much small arms ammunition to fire on training as we wanted it. And the atmosphere was very much different.
You mentioned you went on a training exercise there with cavalry. What were you actually doing?
Oh, I think it's very hard for me to remember that exactly, but one used to go out supporting the cavalry who, in that part of the world, they used them for going up the valleys, the infantry being up on the heights, doing what they call picketing. And the cavalry were sent forward to go into tribal villages and clear people out, frighten everybody with their swords out, that sort of thing. And we used to go along to support them, using what track or road there was in the valley. We also used to cover the infantry with our machine guns at long range, as we later on did it in Waziristan in earnest. This was just training. It was all the training there, all the war there was aimed at frontier warfare. Warfare against tribesmen, perhaps Afghans, certainly against tribesmen, on very mountainous country. And the armoured cars were supporting weapons for the other arms.
Didn't you find that the armoured cars would go far ahead of the cavalry?
Well, normally we didn't. We used to stay so that our guns could support the cavalry or support the infantry or whoever it was we were working with.
We were a supporting arm, absolutely. But, of course, immune very largely to the enemy, if they were there. And the only problems we had were where roads were blocked, tracks blocked, and we couldn't get across country. These cars of ours had very little cross-country capability. They were very heavy. And once they got into soft ground, then they got stuck. So we had to stay on good ground. And one had to do a certain amount of foot reconnaissance ahead and so on before you moved your cars from one place to another to make sure you could really cover the ground.
But didn't it occur to the cavalry that they didn't have armoured cars, that they didn't have this protection? Did they not?
No, I think we worked together very well, really. They used to trot along the road, and we used to come along behind with a section of cars out. And they used to pretend that there would be a fire from somewhere, and we'd cover it and so on. I never actually operated in Waziristan with cavalry. Funnily enough, as a matter of interest, when I was Colonel Commandant of my regiment in the 60s, we wanted to affiliate with a regiment in Pakistan, and I suggested we should affiliate with the 13th Lancers, which is now a Pakistan regiment. Armoured regiment in the Pakistan Army. And they were delighted to affiliate with the Royal Tank Regiment and did so. And we are still affiliated to them. That based on my experience with them in 1930 in the Zobe. Is that all right?
Did you find that the cars were not suitable for certain terrain?
Oh, well, they weren't really very suitable for the terrain at all, because they were very road-bound, and as there were very few roads and or even tracks, we were very limited in what, in fact, we could do. Luckily, the valleys were fairly narrow in the Zobe, and we could have supported the infantry at reasonable range onto hills when they were picketing, as they used to move along the hill, from one hill to the next hill to the next hill, covering the column, which was supposed to be marching with us. I'm talking of training, as opposed to the real thing, which we did later. But all our cars, these guys were somewhat better, because they had more power, and they had pneumatic tyres. Later on, when we moved up to Rosbach, we changed over with another company. Seven Company came down to relieve us at Quetta, and we went to Rosbach. We took over Crossley armoured cars, and they were had solid tyres, and their cross-country capability was really, honestly, you could almost say nil. The moment they got off the road, they got stuck. So one had to stay on tracks with them. Same time, they were very valuable for supporting infantry, and they were very valuable for convoying, small convoys. When they got in the big convoys, then they were bad, because you wanted to have them forward and back, and in fact the convoy people always wanted them dotted down the columns. No, they weren't great cross-country vehicles, so therefore they weren't entirely adequate. Later on, after my time, they had light tanks out there, which, although their tracks got knocked about by the stones a good deal, the ground being entirely stony, almost entirely stony, they did much better. They had much more cross-country capability than the armoured cars had.
You mentioned that you saw more active service a little later on. Were you given any special role for that?
No. We went to Waziristan after we'd been in Quetta for 2.5 years. We moved up to Waziristan. We motored, actually. It was a very interesting long journey. We started by train. We first of all went on our wheels down to the bottom of the Bolan Pass. And then we got on a train and went to Multan. And then from there we went by road from Multan to Lahore, re-equipped with the Crossley cars there, handed over our cars, the other company, and then went up all the way up the Grand Trunk Road to Rawalpindi and to Peshawar, and finally up the Kahat Pass and eventually to Rasmagh. There we had three sections divided, one at Banu at the bottom of the pass, one in Rasmagh itself with the company headquarters, and one in an outpost called Wana, about 30 miles away, the other side of Jandola, which was the great South Waziristan scouts post. And there, of course, we were up against the Afridi and the Wazir. And these chaps were always at war with us in a sort of quiet and friendly way. If they could snipe a chap, they would. If we could snipe them, that we did. While I was there, I was there about 9 months before I went home on leave, we were building the road which ran from Rosmuc to Jundola and then across the Zobe into Baluchistan. So we were out with on what they call column most of the time, which consisted of engineers and a large number of locals working as labourers, covered by an infantry column and supported by some guns and the armoured cars. And we used to camp every night. The road used to go forward half a mile a day or something of this sort. And that was one of our big jobs.
You merely sat in the car and waited along?
We covered them as we moved along, always watching the heights so that we could give machine gun fire, and several times we had to. When chaps sniped the infantry, we used to poop off to frighten everybody for miles around. And I don't think we ever hit anybody. We weren't really trying to. We were just frightening them.
While you were out there, you did a driving and maintenance and gunnery
yes.
course at Ahmednagar.
Ahmednagar. Ahmednagar, Ahmednagar, in the Deccan.
Yes.
Which was at that time the Royal Tank Corps School, India.
Why did you do that?
Well, you had to do to qualify for promotion to captain in the Royal Tank Corps in those days, you had to do two courses, an instructor's driving and maintenance course and an instructor's gunnery course. And from Quetta, I was sent down twice to Ahmednagar to do this very thing. First of all on a gunnery course, and then later on a D&M course. And to get there, one had to go by train from Quetta to Karachi, 24 hours train. Then you went in the Gulf Mail, British India ship, down as far as Bombay. And then you went from Bombay to Ahmednagar by train up through Pune. It was a very considerable journey and took about 4 or 5 days. Nowadays, I suppose, one would do it in half an hour in an aeroplane. And the courses themselves were very good courses, very excellent courses. They were aimed at armoured cars, of course, only. In those days, we had no tanks in India. And they gave you 2 months, I think the gunnery was, and 3 months the D&M, I think. And they gave you very, very good instruction. And at the end of it, you knew all there was to know about armoured car, gunnery, and driving and maintenance. You then went back to your company and were allegedly to be employed as instructor. Actually, as soon as I went back to my company, I became adjutant. But one had the knowledge then that one could impart to one's soldiers if one had to.
Why had you done that?
Everybody did. Every officer did this because until you got those things and then passed your promotion exam, you couldn't be promoted to captain.
What were the main problems mechanically with the car in terms of spare parts and things?
Well, as far as the Crossleys, well, first of all, the guys, we did have some trouble with spare parts because they were the only cars of their sort in the Indian Army, in India at all. And the spares came from a place called Chaklala, which was up in the northwest frontier province. So if you wanted a spare you hadn't got in your stores, those spares had to come by train from the north of India to Baluchistan. So consequently, you very often had a car off the road waiting spares for several weeks. As far as the Crossley was concerned, this was much easier. There were a lot of Crossleys in India. All the other companies had Crossleys, except one in Cawnpore, which had Rolls. And there were far more spares available. And also, the Crossley was a very, very simple motor car. It had no mechanical problems at all. It had four cylinders, straight pot, an ordinary four-speed gearbox and a final drive to an ordinary axle with a differential and solid tyres. It wasn't in any way a difficult vehicle to drive or to manage. And in some cases, you could almost manufacture small spares in the company. You had lathes, you had a workshop lorry with lathes and all that sort of thing.
Before we leave India, I'd like to return. I haven't asked you too much detail on the actual courses when you did the driving reason.
Yes.
How did they compare with Bovington in terms of standard?
Well, I would have thought the standard at Bovington was much higher because you had much more equipment and you were dealing with a much wider field. You covered tanks, armoured cars, and different types of armoured cars and so on. In India, you only had two types of armoured cars to deal with. You were given a choice as whether you did Guy or Rolls, and then you all did Crossley. It was also a very pleasant life. We didn't work very hard. There was a great deal of shooting. We were out shooting 3 or 4 days a week in the evenings and early mornings. Wonderful duck shooting in the Deccan. And that was the sort of life one lived. I mean, one worked a bit, but you didn't drive yourself into the ground at all. Courses in the morning and then the afternoon. You lay on your bed for a bit, and then in the evening maybe there was something to do, or you went out shooting. The instructors were all as keen on shooting as you were. And the army was a comfortable life in those days. Nobody was made to overdo it at all. And this course could have, I suppose, have been done in half the time if the officers had been pressed. But after all, we weren't. We didn't join the army to be pressed. We joined the army to be good soldiers and to have a jolly good time, and that's what we did.
Were the instructors tank corps men?
Oh, yeah, they were all chaps like us, you see. If you got a distinguished on the driving and maintenance course or a gunnery course, then you were ordered back as an instructor. I had the misfortune to do this. I got a distinguished on the driving maintenance course, and I had a tremendous struggle with my commanding officer, who saved my life and avoided me being sent down there. But I didn't want to go as an instructor there at all. I was much happier with the company. But that's where they came from. They were officers, probably a year or so senior to you, who'd done the previous course or two previous courses, two courses previous, and had got a D or a Q1, as it was called, and were recommended for employment at the school as an instructor.
And what about the gunnery? What kind of thing?
Well, the gunnery was, of course, all machine gun. We didn't have any guns. And also tactical. They taught us what little tactics you could learn about armoured cars. And you went out on exercises, schemes, and a lot of firing. And you also became an absolute expert at the Vickers gun. You could take it to pieces blindfold and put it together again in 30 seconds and all this sort of thing. Whether that was of any value to an officer or not, I wouldn't like to say. But you knew as much or more about the gun than your gunner did in your armoured car.